I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The controversy over the old Chrysler Jeep plant in Ohio started back in the late 90s. At the time, the car factory was the oldest one operating in the U.S. When Chrysler started talking about shutting the plant down, city and state politicians from Toledo and Ohio put together $280 million in tax breaks and services to persuade what's now called Daimler Chrysler to stay and expand. Well, the company took the package and rebuilt its plant, and that's where the matter might have rested. After all, these multi-million dollar taxpayer goodie bags are becoming the norm. Dell got a similar amount to build a new computer plant in North Carolina. Boeing is getting billions from people in Washington State. But back in Toledo, the people who had their land taken away, as well as others who see all this as a form of corporate welfare, took the deal to court. They said it's wrong, and they won. A panel of judges of the Sixth Circuit has decided that big tax breaks at the state level interfere with Congress's right to regulate interstate trade. Now, business groups and city and state officials are in an uproar and ready for a fight. We'd like to hear from you. Do you think that your tax money should be used to lure in large corporations? Is it worth it if it means new jobs? Or do you think it's just another form of corporate welfare? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, one thing that the city of Toledo did when it cut the deal with Daimler Chrysler was it promised to remove a number of homes and businesses so the factory could expand. One couple that said no thank you is the Blankenships. Kim and Herman ran an auto and truck service business, but this summer, after a six-year fight, the city finally forced them out of their business and off their land. Herman Blankenships joining us now on the line from Toledo. Hi, Herman.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for being with us. Now, I understand that there's two cases going on here as far as you're concerned. One of them, you're still fighting for the right to get that business back, or at least to get a proper amount of money for losing it, right?
Right.
But I want to talk about the second case, because that's the one at the heart of our program today. And this one says that these kind of tax deals are questionable. I gather that you think that they're a bad deal.
Well, yeah, all it does is cost the taxpayers more money. The taxpayers are the ones that keep the state and stuff going, and they just turn around and give our money away like it's nothing. And when they run low, they come back and say, we need more. They raise their taxes. And, the companies, from our business standpoint, when we needed something for our business, we had to go buy it. Nobody gave it to us. These big corporations, they have a lot more money than small businesses, so why can't they buy what they need?
Well, these big businesses also manage to persuade city fathers and state politicians that they're going to, either maintain jobs or bring new ones in. Let's talk about Daimler Chrysler. They did fix up the factory. They're even talking about another expansion. At the end of it all, isn't that a good thing for Toledo?
Well, yeah, it's kind of good that they're expanding, but when they did all this expansion, they went to robots and everything else. So the Chrysler plant here went from having 5,000 employees down to having about 3,300 employees, and they have some temporaries, which get no benefits or anything.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, they lost 1,700 jobs that were good-paying jobs. And, yeah, they're expanding here now, and they're going to bring in 700 more jobs. But the jobs are from foreign companies, and they're going to be $10 hour jobs. Why should we give them all the tax benefits for $10 an hour jobs?
Are you saying that if they're going to give money to big businesses like Daimler Chrysler, they ought to be helping out companies like Kim's Auto and Truck Service? Or are you saying, wait a second here, maybe we shouldn't be using taxpayer money at all to help out businesses?
Well, I'm saying that the small businesses don't get any breaks.
Right.
And the big companies are more able to afford stuff than small businesses. So why should they get all of these benefits?
Tell me something, Herman. I mean, the court is eventually going to decide, and it's expected this is going all the way to the Supreme Court either side lets it go. Is that right?
Right.
Yeah. So we're eventually going to get a final decision from judges somewhere. But what What's the overall message that you have for people who are sitting in their cars or sitting at home listening to you, scratching their heads, going, gee, I thought this was a good thing for my town or my state?
Well, you know, these corporations, they have to build their stuff somewhere. You know, Daimler Chrysler has to build Chrysler products somewhere. In Toledo here, they already have a workforce. They have everything that they need in Toledo. So actually, it would be a little bit on the foolish side for them to leave the area. And all I can see that they're doing is going after more and more freebies. You know, it cost our school system. The schools had to give up $100,000 of taxes over the next 10 years.
Yeah.
And the next thing you know, it was on the ballot to raise the taxes for the schools. So it comes down and it starts costing the taxpayers money. Now, these companies, they make billions of dollars in profits. Why do the taxpayers have to pick up for these corporations? They don't do it for the small corporations. When you're in business, you're supposed to be treated equally, and it just isn't happening that way.
Herman, I want to wish you good luck on your own court case, and thank you for being with us on the program today.
Well, thank you.
Herman Blankenship joining us there on the line from his home in Toledo, Ohio, looking right across the street at a piece of land that was taken away from him by the city, part of its right of eminent domain, in a deal that was put together some 6 years ago to provide land and services to Daimler Chrysler so they could expand their old Jeep plant there now, and the work has been done. The expansion has taken place. There is more coming. That's what we want to talk about this hour. How far should taxpayers' dollars go to providing support for companies like Daimler Chrysler, like Dell Computers? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's bring our guest in who'll be with us for the balance of the hour. Greg Leroy is joining us from NPR's Washington studio. He's executive director of Good Jobs First. Hi, Greg.
Good morning, Dick. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Good Jobs First. What is that?
We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan research group tracking best practices in state and local economic development. And we look a lot at situations like you're talking about today.
Are you involved in this case?
No, we're not. We have no role in the case at all.
Okay. Dan Navin is also with us. He's managing director of legislative affairs with the Ohio Chamber of Commerce. He's on the line from state capital, Columbus, Ohio. Hi, Dan.
Good morning.
Dan, you make the case that these tax breaks are more than a good thing, that they're actually necessary. How do you make that case?
Well, Dick, I make the case because, as Mr. Blankenship alluded to, Ohio or any community that's involved in trying to attract industrial development is ordinarily in competition with other states who want to lure the same kind of high-value, high-paying jobs that a manufacturing or industrial development project represents. And so you're in competition.
Does that mean it's like a bidding war?
No, I don't think it's necessarily a bidding war, but certainly when you're involved in competition, you always want to put your best foot forward in order to induce, entice, attract, whatever term you want to use, that project, because it represents revenues for local communities as well as jobs for your citizens.
And Greg Leroy, what happens when the best foot forward becomes the biggest package of tax incentives? Is that an acceptable way of doing it as far as you're concerned?
I think there's many problems with deals like this one, and not just this deal in particular, but the whole trend it represents. And I disagree with Mr. Navin. I think it is a bidding war, and certainly 19 years ago, 30 states competed for the General Motors Saturn plant. It was a bidding war out and out. Governors going on the Phil Donahue show, pitching their wares and so on. This is not a new phenomenon. It's reached proportions and costs now that are really stepping on a lot of people's toes.
Now, the court ruling says, and I'm going to lean a little bit on the legal language here, that Ohio's franchise tax credit for new manufacturing machinery and equipment is invalid when you hold it up against the constitutional right of Congress to regulate interstate trade. I don't want to pick that apart because it gets too technical for me. Is that, though, Greg, in your view, kind of like a loophole that was found as a way for the court to say this is a bad thing? Or do you think the courts are actually saying, bidding wars, maybe not such a good thing for people in Ohio or North Carolina?
Yeah, well, I think it goes to the core of the competition, of the definition of the word competition. As Mr. Navin pointed out, their states are competing. The question is, how should they compete? And should they compete until they overspend competing for company-specific deals like this one. I think a more enlightened philosophy and trying to divine the intent of the founding fathers writing this clause was that they did intend for the states to compete on their overall tax policies and their overall public goods, that is what they produce with taxes, the school system and the infrastructure and the quality of life they produce with libraries and parks and things. They didn't intend, I think the people who initiated this lawsuit, they didn't intend for states to compete for specific deals, because when they compete for specific deals, they spend too much.
Now, Dan Navin, you work at the legislature. You also work with the Chamber of Commerce. You know the way that business and politicians need to work together. What I'm wondering here, imagine something for me. If the court case were actually to be held up, if these sorts of deals were deemed to be illegal from now on, would there be a benefit there? Would there be a kind of leveling where you didn't have to bid against people in Pennsylvania or Kentucky or West Virginia?
Dick, I don't believe so, because if there were some sort of one-size-fits-all type of scheme, states would be severely constricted in providing incentives for investment that are unique to their particular states.
But if all states were equally constricted, would that not be fair?
Well, but that's not what, in my view, the Constitution provides. The Constitution provides that states have their own plenary authority to develop incentive packages or economic development packages that allow them to compete for investment. And I think this, if this three-judge ruling would be allowed to stand, would severely constrict the state's ability, particularly a state like Ohio, who, as you know, in the last few years has severely lost a heck of a lot of jobs, and particularly in the manufacturing sector. I think it would severely constrict our ability to not only attract new investment, but clearly to retain the manufacturing jobs that we currently have.
Greg LeRoy, I mean, let's not use Ohio as an example. Let's talk about states like Nebraska or Kansas that don't necessarily have this wonderful river system that Ohio boasts. If the state politicians, city politicians in places like that are willing to put up money to get in a call center, to get in something that helps or protects or saves the jobs in a city, it's kind of hard to argue against their own goodwill in trying to do that.
Certainly, there is, you know, a home rule and states' rights. I'm not arguing that. Without getting into too many legal complexities, we should remind ourselves the average state today has more than 30 different kinds of economic development incentive programs. This ruling only invalidated one of Ohio's. People looking at these think there's a spectrum of vulnerability and that some of them, like the one that was ruled invalid, are much more vulnerable because they're much more favoritistic, much more costly than the others.
All right, Connection listeners, pick up your morning paper. You'll find out about $100 million that the city of Washington, D.C. is proposing to spend taxpayers' money on a baseball stadium. Is that the same thing? $242 million to bring another Dell computer plant to North Carolina. $3.2 billion for Boeing to build the new 787 in Washington State in a plant that is already established there. Where does it end? Do you worry about these kinds of tax incentives going too far? Or is this the price to pay for business close to home? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. This hour we're talking about the Daimler-Chrysler court case in Toledo, Ohio, where the Sixth Circuit has decided that maybe it's not such a good idea to have city and state tax breaks given to large corporations. That's something that's working its way through the court. It's part of a bigger question, though. And the bigger question is, should taxpayers' money, large chunks of it, be given to large profitable corporations in order to lure them into certain states or cities? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Greg LeRoy is with us. He's executive director of Good Jobs First, joining us from Washington. Dan Navin is with the Ohio Chamber of Commerce, where he is Managing Director of Legislative Affairs. And these two gentlemen will help us with questions, whether we're talking about Toledo or some other part of the country. Let's go to Greensboro, North Carolina, where Catherine's on the line. Hi there, Catherine.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate it, and I like the show.
Thank you. What are you thinking?
I'm thinking, I live in Guilford County, and we are right now in a bidding war with our neighboring county to get this $100 million Dell plant. And I just opened up today's paper and found out that the neighboring county has offered, you know, over twice as much as we have offered. We've offered $12.4 million in cash and incentives for Dell to come here. They've offered $28 million. And, you know, I just have a hard time understanding why we're offering on top of the $242.5 million that the state has pledged for the project, why we're offering this extra money and our school systems are terrible and our...
Catherine, do you know if that money is going to Dell or are these or are the tax breaks being offered from Guilford and neighboring counties, you know, designed to be a part of the state's package?
The Guilford, I've got the paper right here, actually, the Greensboro News and Record, and it says that Forsyth County's proposal includes a $3.5 million cash grant, $2.5 million for preparation of 189 acres in a park for the plant, $8.76 million in annual cash grants to be doled out over 15 years.
That's a lot of just straight cash giveaways, Dan Navin. Hang on just a sec, Catherine, don't go anywhere. Dan Navin, that's a lot of grant money.
My response to that, Dick and Catherine, is that Ohio, as well as North Carolina and many other states, have similar discussions about the appropriateness of intrastate competitive bidding wars, if you will, where you have county against county, municipality against municipality, but fundamentally that is an issue to be resolved by the state. We think we are taking an approach in Ohio, or at least there's discussion about taking more of a regional approach so that you don't have the city going against an adjacent township or an adjacent county, because the feeling is that that is somewhat counterproductive.
Dan, I want to go back to Catherine here, but I need you to help me with something. Dell Computers is a really profitable corporation. How can they make a case to anyone in North Carolina that they need grants to build a factory?
I don't know the specifics of that, Mr. Gordon, but the fact of the matter is that it's an issue of competition. These jobs, such as Dell is probably involved in and holding out as providing, are very valuable in terms of that community. And in order to compete for that investment, states have to be willing to provide these incentives in order to be able to generate and attract the jobs that they represent.
Do they, Greg Leroy, do the states have to be willing to provide this kind of money? Is that where we are?
No, I mean, North Carolina is really a test tube case of the slippery slope. Until 1996, the state pursued what I would call almost a libertarian philosophy of not doing deals like Dell, but just having a good school system, keeping taxes and regulation as low as possible for everybody, having a very kind of vanilla-flavored menu of generic incentives for everybody, but no big special deals. This deal, Dell deal, is unusual because, as you mentioned, the incentive package is worth at least $242 million for a plant that Dell estimates will cost between $100 and $115 million to build. So the state's incentive package exceeds by more than two times the cost of the construction of the facility. It's just an unusual story. And when they made the announcement, they also kind of set off this bidding war that your caller is calling in about by announcing that they might come to one of three counties.
Catherine, I mean, when you sit and talk with friends about this, are you saying, it's a lot of money, but man, it might be, you know, jobs replacing the textile jobs that disappeared. It might be, for the long term, a reason for the kids to stick around.
You know, I don't. And I've heard some people talk about that. But in the long run, it provides 1,700 jobs. And that's not a lot in the long term when you look at how many we've lost in the manufacturing industry. And it's just... it's not worth it.
Is it just that it's too much money that's being offered, or is it that the money packages like this shouldn't be a part of bringing companies to a county or to a town, Catherine?
I think it's almost a necessary evil when you have these major companies that will provide so much income towards the county or state that they, you know, decide to build their plant in. I think, you know, unfortunately, it's part of what we have to deal with, but mm-hmm. I think it's just gotten out of hand in our situation.
All right, Catherine, thanks for your call. Dan Nabin,
if you don't mind.
Yeah, come. Jump in here.
If you and your listeners, I probably should try to explain something here. It's not, I think part of the attraction and the willingness of North Carolina, without speaking for the three counties involved, why they're willing to kick in a little bit to try to entice Dell to locate there is that not just the 1,700 jobs itself are at stake, but there is a potential multiplier effect from a large company and a very successful company like a Dell locating in your community, whereby it attracts supplier companies. It attracts other companies that want to be part of a bigger cluster and thus can create even more jobs and more economic growth and more investment in that larger regional community that is, at least in my mind, speaking from afar, might be also a partial explanation for why these counties are willing to provide some additional incentives and kick-in money to attract Dell to their community.
All right. It's an important part of the equation. We will talk further about that in the hour, what this means over the long term, because it shouldn't be seen just in context of the one-time grant. I want to go to Madison, Indiana, for our next call. Ryan's joining us from there. Hi, Ryan. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call.
What are you thinking?
Well, I live in a small community, manufacturing prevalent here.
Yeah.
In Indiana, and my company has also applied to the city council for grants for an expansion that they're doing, and which will involve mostly automation. And they've promised the city that this will, in the end, increase jobs. And I really don't see that happening.
What if they don't get the money, Ryan? What's the company saying it will happen?
Well, they're threatening to. They say that they're willing to relocate to China. They've alluded to that. But when they've been, when it printed on the front page of our paper, they denied that they actually said that. But I think that they're using it as alluding to it as a threat. And I think that they are doing that because of all the, you know, all the hubbub about China's economy being so aggressive lately.
Let's just assume for the sake of this conversation, Ryan, that in fact they would relocate somewhere else. Does that mean that it is worthwhile for the state of Indiana or Madison to come up with the money to keep them there?
Well, it's tough, really. But I really don't think that they would locate. So I think that they're jumping on the bandwagon of what's happening with Chrysler, Daimler, and Dell and other companies like that.
You know, and Greg LeRoy, this is something that your organization tries to make sense of. When a corporation is, you know, taking advantage of a vulnerable part of the country and when it's really, you know, desperately needs the money in order to stay viable or to stay in one place.
Yeah, I think we should distinguish between distressed companies and other kinds of companies. And I think it is appropriate for a state or local entity or regional entity to have a special high-risk loan fund or some other special pot of money that's designated for companies that are distressed. And obviously, you need to be careful with that money and make sure that it's applied in ways that has a good chance of succeeding in getting the company out of distress and saving the jobs. But we shouldn't be letting healthy companies pose as distressed companies or because it really amounts to a burden shift at one point. If this company gets a special break, well, then what does that say about the tax burden to sustain public services for the rest of the employers in the community?
If you don't mind, let me play on what Mr. LeRoy just said.
Yeah.
He made a distinction between distressed communities versus the remainder of companies. Well, the tax credit, one of the tax credits at issue in the Kuno case, in the Daimler Chrysler case, was in fact a distressed community, Toledo, being able to do things over and above the norm in order to make it competitive with any of the other communities either across the state or outside the boundaries of the state of Ohio. So at least in our view, the Ohio investment tax credit that was at issue here made some accommodation to try to take into account that Toledo was a distressed community and needed to be able to avoid losing the Daimler Chrysler, the Jeep plant there, and therefore be able to attract a new level of investment from the company.
Let me go back to Ryan in Madison, Indiana. Ryan, I'm just wondering if there was some way of actually judging that it's a fair request or it's a bit of blackmail. Would you feel a bit better about it?
I would feel better, but I think that would be tough. I mean, it's easy to say that it's definitely viable. We need the money to stay competitive. We may need the money to stay ahead of the game, but there's definitely no threat of relocation, I don't think, in this instance. And I think that it'd be hard to argue whether it was viable or not.
All right, Ryan, thanks for your call. Let me go to Greg LeRoy here just on one question about how you make these kinds of decisions and what you do with that. What happens if a town like Madison says, yeah, okay, we'll give you the money, the company gets the money, and the company, you know, locks its doors anyway? Are there legal ways of saying, we helped out and you let us down?
Yes, it's called a clawback or money-back guarantee, recapture contract provision, which are increasingly common, that could be written into an agreement to get the taxpayer money back if the company failed to deliver on its promises. I just want to address something quickly that Mr. Navin said. He referred to distressed communities. I was talking about distressed companies. Toledo is a distressed area, and this was an enterprise zone deal in part. But an important thing to keep in mind, thinking about Ryan's company or any other company, all state and local taxes combined as a cost of doing business for the average company in America are only 1.2%, and then they get to deduct them from their federal income tax. So after deductibility, they all add up to 0.8%. of the average cost of a company doing business. That figure is dwarfed by everything else, by labor and materials and logistics and transportation and
You're losing me here. What's the point that you're trying to make with this?
The point is that taxes are a microscopic marginal cost for most companies, and therefore it's hard for them to influence the outcome of a company like Ryan's or other companies because they're so small.
So what, if they're so small, why does it matter so much to the companies to get the tax breaks that we're talking about here, Greg? I mean, it must matter to them.
It's become so easy to get to spend a little bit of money lobbying to get a lot of money in tax breaks. The rate of return seeking these is fantastic sometimes.
You're listening to The Connection. My name's Dick Gordon. Dan Navin, your perspective on why and how much these taxes matter to the corporations.
Well, I don't know the source of Mr. LeRoy's figures, but I am well aware, because I work with these companies, that the issue is more what the cost of doing business is at that particular plant or in that particular state. So that state and local taxes on the Jeep plant in Toledo, Ohio, is the issue, not what Daimler Chrysler's overall level of taxation is relative to all of its other expenses.
Isn't it all on the same balance sheet at the end?
No. The reason is because in many companies, there are separate Ohio operating companies or separate operating companies that are particular to specific states. And so there are a number of subsidiary or affiliated companies that have their own tax liability and have the option in all of these states to file a separate tax return. So
let me just stop you on that point, Dan. We're getting a little bit technical here. I don't want to lose sight of the sort of principal point here. Let's go back to our callers, to Binghamton, New York. David's on the line. Hi, David.
Hi, Dick. How are you?
Fine. What are you thinking?
Well, here's what I'm thinking. I'm the owner of a small business called blackandwhitecookies.com, and we manufacture cookies. And one of the reasons we were lured to a community like Binghamton is because it's part of the state of New York Empire Zone, and it's also incentivized by the community in Binghamton. We wouldn't have been able to open our doors if it wasn't for these incentives. So on a smaller basis, if we start to get rid of a lot of the incentives for major corporations, smaller corporations like mine would not be able to exist.
Now, were you already in existence before the good people of Binghamton said, come and set up shop here?
Yes, we were. We were actually operating out of a shared kitchen in New York City. And the incentives that Binghamton gave us, we were actually able to cut our costs less than half of what we were paying in Manhattan to go up to Binghamton. Not only are we going to hire local Binghamton employees because of this incentive program, we also buy all of our goods supplies locally in Binghamton as well, because being a baking company, we also need stuff locally from farms. So.
Can you help me with something, David, though? When you listen to the questions or the suspicions in the minds of people like David and Christine, how do you answer them? How does anybody really know that Black and White Cookies isn't just trying to, you know, scam a little bit of extra cash off the top? And in fact, it really needs the money. How does the average citizen know how to judge that?
Well, I mean, I think the real way to look at it is that if you take a look at communities like Binghamton that are struggling and are doing the best they can to really revitalize their downtown, and we're part of another project that involves a few other businesses at the same time. And when you take a look at that and you look at the fact that if we were in New York, we probably still wouldn't be in existence. And, you know, this is simply an economic decision that makes sense, is providing jobs, and also is enabling us to take our business to the next level.
All right, David, thanks for that. Just a quick one, Greg, from you. It's not, I hate to use this, but it's not all black and white, is it?
No, and I mean, obviously Manhattan's got to be a high cost of business place to make cookies, so I'm shocked to hear he was there to begin with.
No, no, but I guess the point that I'm making is that there are places and times and circumstances where, as David explains, it may well be worth the while of the town and the people to say, yeah, we need to spend some of our own money to bring people, you know, like David, from New York to Binghamton.
Yeah, and we favor using incentives, especially those in kind of what we call a cluster strategy, where you pick a cluster of companies that has a promising future, that are already there or have a chance to thrive for a reason in the community, and you help a cluster of companies get good and grow together.
So, Connection listeners, how does it work? How do you use the taxpayers' money to bring large corporations without going too far, without getting into that kind of bidding war where it's in fact millions of dollars? In some cases, we're talking about a town offering more than its own annual budget in incentives to bring companies in. 1-800-423-8255. Your thoughts on what it takes to keep and maintain jobs and when people are going too far. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection. I'm going to borrow a line from President Bush here. Even though you pay your tax money to the city or the state, it's still your money when it's sitting in those coffers. So what do you think about it being used to bring in large corporations? Is there a line there where sometimes states and cities are going too far? Or is this the way to get corporations and get good jobs close to home? 1-800-423-8255. Next to Grand Junction, Colorado. David's on the line. Thanks for calling, David.
Morning. This is probably one of the most devastating things that I can ever think of that hit Grand Junction in the 80s. We had probably some of the worst poverty out here of any of the, well, I can't say of any of the states, but among blacks, unemployment was at 80%. Whites, it was officially at 14%, but probably well into the 20% range. And the idea that one county would be able to suck away the jobs of another poor county, you know, in Pennsylvania or in Florida or someplace else. We had a huge corporation called Sunstrand come out here. They made jet engine pumps, and master machinists out here were making $6.50 an hour. I ran into a guy in a yard sale, as a matter of fact. He was having a yard sale. He had quit Sunstrand because he was making three of these pumps a day. Sunstrand was selling them at $750,000 each, and he was being paid $56 a day for them to make a fantastic amount of profit.
So, David, are you telling me that the taxpayers' money when it's used to try and keep or maintain a business doesn't always work out? Is that the point that you're making?
Well, it's not just that. If you read Ben Franklin's autobiography, if you read, there's a famous old textbook used in high schools back in the middle part of the last century called The Origins of the American Revolution, and it goes into detail about how these major corporations the money is represents all of us. The money of the United States represents the strength and vitality of the country. And when these major corporations can then take the value of the money and play it against each other's state lines, they can create false senses of value.
Is there a way to stop them from playing against each other, David? I don't know that we're necessarily quarreling about whether or not the money can be used to offer some incentives.
Let me just tell you, out there in Grand Junction in the 80s, you could make more money bartering and raising chickens and eggs in your backyard than you could with these major corporations. And these corporations were laughing all the way to the bank, and nowadays they're taking the money. We've even got Boeing really isn't even an American company anymore. They're selling more overseas, and they're taking all of their profits overseas. And
David, I'm going to stop you here because I want to turn to Dan Navin on this. I haven't chatted with you for a bit, Dan. This is part of what David is talking about is that bringing them in doesn't necessarily provide the benefits that may be promised in the first place. But one of the things that Greg said a little earlier in the program is that there are, you know, clauses written into these contracts where if the companies don't meet the expectations of the city fathers or the state politicians, then there are opportunities of getting money back. How fair are those contracts from the corporate perspective?
Dick, we have willingly supported, or at least certainly not opposed, such clawback provisions in Ohio, because we have a regime where so-called tax incentive review councils at the local level can review on an annual basis whether the company is meeting the conditions of the granting of either the tax exemption, particularly the property tax exemption, and can claw back, quote unquote, the property tax reductions into the future, what based upon violation or not meeting up to the promises that the company made.
Has it ever happened, Dan?
Yes, it has. Yeah. Yes, it has. And more communities are getting more and more aggressive in enforcing those provisions in the agreements.
So, Greg, it sounds like that's one way of balancing things out a little bit.
Yeah, and actually, there's interesting context on this issue there in Ohio, especially property tax abatements, which was another issue in the lawsuit. Toledo, a state auditor found, gives up about 14% of its school revenue to companies in foregone property taxes through property tax abatements.
That's sort of averaged year over year over year, or is that just in one year?
That's every year.
Okay.
But about 30% of the high school students in the system don't graduate. It's one of the more distressed school districts in the state, and there's been a number of controversies within the state of Ohio about how to finance schools because they're overly dependent on property taxes, which in turn are hurt a lot by these abatements.
1-800-423-8255. So many ways of looking at this. We'd like to hear from you. Next to Durham, North Carolina. Hubert's there. Hi, Hubert.
Hello.
Thanks for calling. What are you thinking?
I just wanted to let you know, I work for the European Union, which is sort of the federal government of Europe.
We've heard of that here, yes.
Sorry?
I said yes. In fact, we have heard of that here.
Okay, good. Okay, just to explain it for your listeners. And by the way, I think NPR is an excellent station. It's really excellent. I just wanted to let you know that in the European Union, we have in the European Union treaty, as if it were in the U.S. Constitution, in our Constitution, we have very clear rules on this, which say that the states, the individual states and the cities, et cetera, in principle, they cannot give such subsidies just to attract companies to come to them rather than go to another place in the U.S. In the European Union, what we're doing is what you mentioned as all states being equally constricted. There's a sort of basic prohibition, And then there are exceptions. For instance, one participant mentioned distressed companies. Mm-hmm. In the European Union, you can help, as a state or as a city, you can help distressed companies once every 10 years. Or if your region is lagging behind in its economy and it really needs a boost, then the region can say, or the state can say, we will give, for instance, Dell, if North Carolina would really be lagging behind in its economy, if Dell a certain amount of money.
But Hubert, let me just ask you another question, though, that comes up in, when these two parts of the world are compared against each other, because it seems to me that quite often where the conversation gets stalled is in definitions over whether or not a company is a private company or whether or not a company is already getting a substantial amount of state support. For example, the Airbus Industries, which was a consortium with lots of government support from around the European Union. You know, the Americans will bang on the table and say that's not right. The Europeans will bang on the table and say you can't give subsidies to Boeing. And it seems at some level that they're not even talking the same language.
Yeah, well, that's a good example, but that's a bit at a different level in a way. That's at the World Trade Organization level. At the World Trade Organization level, there are rules on also against subsidies, but they are, let's say, they apply to the U.S. as a whole and they apply to the European Union as a whole. So, and there's a specific agreement in the World Trade Organization about civil aviation and subsidies to civil aviation. So that's sort of a different matter. What I'm sort of saying is that in addition to these rules at a global level, which restrict subsidies, but not very, they wouldn't keep North Carolina from helping Dell, for instance, or Ohio from helping Toledo from helping Daimler Chrysler.
Hubert, if you don't mind, let me just step in here because there's a point that you began with that I'd like to hear from Greg LeRoy on, and that is that this takes us back to the very heart of the court case that we're talking about here, Congress's right to manage interstate trade. If we look at the example that Hubert's talking about, without getting tangled too much up in things that don't necessarily compare, should we be talking about, ought Washington to be thinking about genuinely regulating interstate trade in the way that the EU does, so there isn't the kind of bidding war? If we wanted to get away from it, would it have to come from Congress being more active here?
It would, and I'm so glad he called, and what he's saying is valid, and it's ironic. There's more cooperation among the countries of Europe signing the Treaty of Rome than we have among the 50 states here. And it's becoming an issue of economic competitiveness for America. We're spending way too much money fighting each other among the states when the real issue, especially in manufacturing and now in the service sector, mm-hmm. with outsourcing, is globalization. I like the idea of Congress using a carrot and a stick, the way we got the states to agree to lower their blood alcohol content level to 0.8 for the definition of drunk driving. We use the carrot of offering the states 10% more of their highway money if they lowered their levels that way. We could do the same thing with our Department of Labor training money, our Department of Commerce infrastructure money, saying to states, if you certify that you're not using taxpayer dollars to pay Peter to rob Paul, so to speak, to pirate jobs from other states, we'll give you the extra money.
You're listening to The Connection. My name's Dick Gordon. Our next call from Jeffersonville, Indiana, and Donna's on the line. Hi, Donna.
Hello.
Thanks for calling. What are you thinking?
Well, I was elected official in Jeffersonville in the city council for 8 years, which has been a few years back. But I know that the tax incentive, if we did not use those incentives for companies, that we wouldn't have been able to locate a lot of the companies into our community. The problem that I see is that most people do not understand abatement process. It's very complicated. There's personal property abatement, and then there's the real estate property abatement, and it's not forever.
Let's talk about the overall notions at stake here, though, Donna, because in some cases we're talking about free land and grants and offers of help for job training and water and sewer and roads and all that sort of thing. So if we just sort of look at that as an umbrella, I get the point that this is very, very complicated for you, but you've got this 8 years of experience there. Is it getting worse?
I think the problem lies in the fact that, at least in our community, the companies come in and they make all these promises. This is what we'll give back to the community, and certainly in our circumstance, the jobs have come. But we live on the Ohio River, and you know we have grain and steel companies, and we have a good location. But the problem is that And your guests say that there's a monitoring of these companies. In our case, there is not. There is no one that goes back in 5 years and says, okay, have you fulfilled your promise of this many jobs, or have you given to charities or whatever it is that they have promised. There is no monitoring after they have received their abatement. And I think that is a big problem.
Dick, what Don is alluding to is the fact that, and I don't want to put words in her mouth, but I think maybe some of the communities in Indiana have not had long enough experience with, in terms of negotiating these kinds of deals. Ohio's property tax exemption program has been in effect since the very early 80s. And over the last 20 years, not only have local officials become more sophisticated in the negotiating process, but also there have been reforms to the process that have included these clawback provisions and the local communities thereby getting more aggressive in enforcing those agreements.
Dan, let me step in here for half a second. We've only got a couple of minutes left on the program, and I do really need the both of you to help me out with a big picture here. The court case is going to go on to the Supreme Court. Dan Navin, what is really at stake here? If the Supreme Court says, yes, in fact, this is a good decision, what does it mean for states and businesses?
What is really at stake here, Dick, is the ability of states to develop their own economic investment attraction strategies. Yes, using their tax code, but also trying to overcome the problem of high labor costs, of additional training costs. When they're in a globally competitive marketplace.
All right, Greg LeRoy, what do you think is at stake in this case?
I think if the case holds and the principle of de-escalation begins to take effect, it'll be a great thing for economic development in this country. State budget deficits will be eased. Money will be saved that can be better spent on training and education and assistance to small business and infrastructure and other things that are really proven winners for economic development.
Well, it's clear from our callers that people have a lot of interest in this from right across the country. So, Greg, I thank you for being with us on the program.
Thank you, Dick.
Greg LeRoy is Executive Director of Good Jobs First, and Dan Navin, I thank you for your time as well.
Thank you, Dick.
Dan is Managing Director of Legislative Affairs with the Ohio Chamber of Commerce. We also talked on the program with Herman Blankenship from Kim's Auto and Truck Service in Toledo, Ohio. He is one of the plaintiffs in the case that is being heard there. Our website is www.theconnection.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.